Spring is here, and so are the deals at Dee Dee's Discounts. From trendy outfits to home makeovers, Dee Dee's has all the deals you need. I'm talking everything from sandals and sundresses to spring throw pillows and scented candles. You love a good deal? Get in your bag and get to Dee Dee's Discounts.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. With me is Caitlin. How are you doing, Caitlin?
I'm doing great. How about you, Mark?
I am doing well. We are going to be talking about games we've been playing lately. We're going to be talking about our retro game in our Goof segment. We're going to be talking about Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers. And I have so many questions about the broader universe about this, Caitlin. You have no idea. I am not well-versed in this particular universe of jacket-wearing rodents who apparently solve crimes. Then we will talk about our feature game, which is Hellblade 2 Senua's Saga. And we're going to close things out with some shameless hyping of upcoming titles in what we call Shout. So, let us begin. Caitlin, what has been occupying your attention lately?
So, this last week, I was playing some Monster Hunter Wilds beta. They're having an open beta weekend kind of thing. So, I've played a couple of times in the last few days, and it's been awesome. I played once in a group of two, once in a group of four, a couple times with randos. I mean, it's the same Monster Hunter that I know and love, but they've made some adjustments. The UI, I don't know if Monster Hunter has ever had an interface that I felt was intuitive and good, because I always feel like there's some part of it I have to struggle with at first. And some of the controls, like controlling the bird mount that you get in Monster Hunter Wilds feels ridiculous. Like, you can kind of set the bird on like auto run, and it will follow a path to get to whatever monster you're hunting, which is great. But I'm not always clear on, after I stop the auto run and start running for myself, how I get back to auto run. And I mean, some of this is just solved by learning the buttons better, but there's quite a lot to learn when you first start with Monster Hunter Wilds. So I haven't gotten to that part yet. But the new wound mechanics are really fun. Monsters can get wounds, and then you can target those to deal extra damage. The bow, which of course is my weapon apparently in multiple games, but in Monster Hunter Wilds, it's my main weapon, has a couple new mechanics related to the wounds where you can like focus on them and then do a really big hit. Just, it's super fun. I'm having a lot of fun.
So, as somebody who has only the mildest of experience with Monster Hunter games, what typically changes from Monster Hunter game to Monster Hunter game?
The newer Monster Hunters have kind of gone more into an open world kind of deal. So, starting with Monster Hunter World and then Rise, instead of each area being like a discrete thing with loading screens and like entries and exits, now there's a much bigger map, and you can kind of seamlessly move between areas. In Monster Hunter Rise and World, I believe everything except the city, like your main hunter camp, was, you know, part of this one big map. And Monster Hunter Wilds, you can actually seamlessly go from the camp and out into the wilds and back. So they made it even more open, I guess. But that's been one of the big changes. Otherwise, like, there's different kinds of monsters. Sometimes they add new monsters. Sometimes they retire old ones. Or one from three games ago will come up again. I'm not as well versed on that, but yeah.
So it's broadly like a fighting game in that you expect the core gameplay loop to be exactly the same. You expect the cast to be largely the same. And it's just mostly changing details at the margins? Am I being unfair?
No, I would say, as far as like the actual mechanics and gameplay, yes, largely the same. They will add stuff, like I think Bow got added just a few expansions, a few games ago. They add new mechanics to some of these weapons. So there's new weapons every now and then, new things you can do with these weapons.
you're not differentiating it from fighting game iteration, you realize.
Yeah, no, no, no. I'm saying, like, I'm agreeing with you on that point.
Okay,
sure.
Okay.
Cast-wise, the cast does change. I don't know that there's, other than the fact that there's palicos, which are a little, like, kind of humanoid kitty cats that can talk, and they follow you around, and they're your buddy.
Oh, I remember those.
Yeah. Other than palicos, there's not a ton of consistency between characters. I don't know if there's ever any characters that actually appear in multiple games.
But these are not story-heavy experiences to start with.
No, definitely not. And the monsters, I assume there's generally some consistency.
Yeah, the monsters are the more salient cast, I imagine. You're going to be spending more time with them after all.
Yeah, and each Monster Hunter game tends to have, like, their title monster. Like, I would consider Monster Hunter World, Nergigante was one of the big introductions. It was, like, a new Elder Dragon, and it was black and really cool looking, and I actually have a statue of it because it's like my favorite monster ever.
And you show your enthusiasm for this monster by murdering it repeatedly and scavenging its corpse?
And getting murdered by it repeatedly, yes.
You show affection in strange ways, but now I know your love language. This is good to know.
Yeah, yeah. And the character creation in Monster Hunter Wilds is actually very good. I think that in the later editions, they've been allowing like more customization of your character. And of course, I mean, part of Monster Hunter is, you know, you need to make cool-looking outfits. You're playing dress-up with monster parts that you rip off of the monsters that you've killed. But character creation, like the amount of customization you can do to the character that you're going to be playing and to your palico, actually, is impressive, especially considering you don't see your character's face all that much outside of cutscenes.
You get to dress up your cat?
Yeah, so palicos, there's both hunter armor and palico armor.
That's awesome.
They all the armor looks somewhat, you know, similar to the monster that it came from, and there's some pretty ridiculous looking kitty cat outfits you can make.
Is it using the RE engine? Because if it is, that's the same engine that powered, you know, Dragon's Dogma 2, and the character customization there was pretty ridiculous.
I'm not sure.
So I've been meaning to try Monster Hunter Rise for quite a while, or at least it's been on my sort of peripheral list, and only Rise because it is the one that's available on Game Pass. I have no ability to situate the different Monster Hunters in any kind of chronological order because their naming convention has abandoned numerals for a very long time.
Yes.
The different nouns don't lend themselves to any kind of ordering. This is what Wikipedia was invented for, so as to be able to order put these things in order and see what's what. I played maybe an hour's worth of Monster Hunter on a 3DS version. I don't even know which.
Yeah, maybe.
I remember it being stultifyingly boring. But that having been said, sometimes there are stultifyingly boring games that I very much enjoy, like some versions of Destiny. And then again, maybe I just wasn't interacting with it properly because I did get the sense, the very strong sense, that there was this entire universe of convention that the game would not deign to explain to me. Because,
yeah,
I mean, that's the thing, when you have this accretion of, again, not entirely unlike fighting games, where it was only recently, somewhat recently, I'd say, that fighting games actually decided to include lexicons that are sufficiently robust to explain even what the interface was already telling you. It's like, oh, this, I triggered a Roman cancel. What on earth is that? And so it's only recently that they would bother to explain these things, like frame data and nonsense like that. So when Monster Hunter assumes you're initiated, it was pretty daunting.
Yeah. I had the same experience with the very first Monster Hunter game that I tried, which was either on 3DS or the Wii U. I forget which one. But it was rough. And I remember I was trying to do a solo hunt of some monster, and I ran out the 45-minute timer and didn't kill it. I was like, oh my god, this game is not for me. Whatever. But I tried it again with multiplayer, and that got better. I do think that starting in World, I believe it got a little bit more beginner-friendly, just in that it helps explain a bit more. So Rise, hopefully, would benefit from that as well. And by the way, it is the RE engine. I just looked it up.
I would imagine that's pretty much what Capcom uses every time.
Yeah.
All that I really know is that, according to anime, there are precisely two video games that exist in the universe that have been published in the past 10 years. One of them is Smash Brothers, and the other is Monster Hunter. And every single Japanese school child has a Switch with Monster Hunter in it. And every once in a while, and I say this because I've seen this happen in like at least three or four different series. Yeah. Every once in a while, you meet the cool adult who also has a Switch and wants to play Monster Hunter with you.
I need to know what this anime is with the Monster Hunter games in it.
There have been several. It's wild.
That's really funny.
Final question. Yeah, yeah. As far as the various Monsters Hunters that you've been playing, how do you think this new one ranks so far? Or is it too soon to tell?
I would say it's too soon to tell because while you can do the hunting and everything, which is very fun, you can't do almost anything in the main camp. Everyone's just like, I'm still setting up.
Oh.
So you can't actually upgrade your gear. You can't craft new gear.
Okay.
So there's a lot of parts of the game that are still kind of locked away. It's only hunting.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like it's... Yeah. That is indeed very beta level.
Yeah.
Okay. So should I try Monster Hunter Rise?
I think you should. Maybe we should do it, you know, one of these next few weeks.
Well, on the topic of things where I'm not elite enough to run with the big boys and girls, including Caitlin, I've been playing a fair amount of Helldivers lately. Mm. And this was because I accidentally jumped into a mission without knowing... Well, accidentally is too strong a word. I jumped into a mission without knowing the difficulty level in advance. And we were playing on Extreme, which is the lowest difficulty level where you can get the super samples. And ever since Helldivers was released, I've been thinking, eh, well, someday I'll get 10 super samples, and then I'll be able to have an extra eagle stratagem on all my airstrikes. Because if there's one thing that Helldivers 2 has taught me, is that war crimes are awesome, and more war crimes is more awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And I have developed a very particular set of skills when playing Helldivers. Number one, I am very good with the Dominator. The Dominator is a very niche weapon. It is my jam. It is what I roll with. And the second thing that I'm reasonably good at with Helldivers is calling in cluster bomb strikes. In that way, Caitlin, I dare say I'm more American than you are. And there have been a number of occasions where my teammates see the ping, they hear the Eagles coming, and they panic. And I just say, don't worry, I've got you. And it's just precisely layered so they're not in danger. I have very, for someone who calls in airstrikes all the damn time, I'm very proud of the fact that I very, very seldom kill my teammates. Anyway, I discovered that Extreme is manageable. And so I started doing solo runs of Helldivers just to try to get these samples. And it was indeed manageable. I can run in Extreme and sometimes even not die at all. And my normal toolkit is able to thrive at that difficulty level. So I've been playing a fair bit of Helldivers. It's really well done. I mean, it's still kind of buggy. There's still weird stuff that happens. I'm a little disappointed that you know, you can pick your favorite set of toys and you're never really forced to mix things up too much. A little bit is helpful with respect to new enemy types. Like, for example, I find that my regular kit isn't as effective against the new enemy type, the Illuminate, as it is against bugs and bots. And I do try to be a generalist, unlike you. As my understanding is, you don't do bugs.
Oh, yeah, I don't fight bugs.
I try to be able to fight whatever people want to fight. So yeah. I like to be able to have a little bit of flexibility. Anyway, so I've been playing a lot of Helldivers 2. I've also been playing a lot of Virtua Fighter 5 Revo. I still don't know what Revo stands for. I've been trying new characters like the Aikido practitioner, who's surprisingly easy. See, I'd gotten in my head that Aikido, given that it's a very, very difficult martial art to practice well, and in a number of other fighting games, the Aikido characters are very, very difficult to use, that the Aikido practitioner in Virtua Fighter 5 would be difficult to use. She is not. She is very straightforward.
Nice.
Especially when compared to Akira, because everyone's easy to use compared to Akira. Setting all that aside, I've also been playing Eternal Strands. I talked about Eternal Strands a few weeks ago in Shout because I was looking forward to it. And not just because Mike Laidlaw, who was the director for Dragon Ages 1, 2, and 3, a.k.a. the good ones, was attached to it, but because I kind of liked the conceit. There was, you know, an action RPG where you can climb all over big things, and Dragon's Dogma 2 definitely didn't do that for me. And so I was hoping that Eternal Strands would be enjoyable. And right away, one of the things that struck me was that Eternal Strands was willing to exercise some degree of visual flourish.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I commented when talking about Dragon's Dogma 2, I found it unrelentingly ugly. Everything looked bland, everything looked unimaginative, everything was muddy looking and not in a sort of gritty way, just in a sort of bland way. And yeah, walking through the wilderness can be difficult to render in a visually impressive way. But one way to do it is to have a sense of style. And Eternal Strands definitely has that. It's almost cel-shaded. It's not the most unique visual aesthetic in video games. It's relatively frequently done. But some of the character designs are really cool. Like, there's this bird human called Aria who looks really impressive and quite striking and utterly unlike other anthropomorphic birds that I've seen in video games before.
Nice.
The story is nothing to write home about, and the dialogue is presented in the same way that an old-school RPG would. So static images with dialogue boxes. The voice acting is pretty good, though. Sadly, nothing in Eternal Strands feels good. It all feels kind of clumsy and janky and unsatisfying. So there's climbing, there's swordplay, there's archery, there's telekinesis, there's elemental magic, and none of it feels good. It all feels either mediocre or downright bad. Just unpleasant to do. Some of this is interface problems, some of this is game balance problems, but overall, they try to spin this idea that you're going to be manipulating a whole bunch of elemental energies and deploying magic and all this. It just doesn't feel good to do, and it's all clumsy and bad feeling. And so consequently, the game, even when it's being visually impressive, is not fun to play.
Oh, that's a bummer.
It is at its best when you're climbing all over a huge thing and trying to stab its weak points. There's this idea of stripping, the equivalent, I'll call them a colossus, even though they're not. But, you know, out of reference to Shadow of the Colossus, obviously, you have to generate weak points rather than discover them. You need to strip away various bits of armor. All the while, it's swatting at you. You need to brace yourself at various times. All of this is okay, but, like, the collision detection never feels super awesome. And so consequently, even at its best, Eternal Strands doesn't feel super good. And so consequently, I'm very disappointed. I played it for a couple hours, but I don't think I'm going to go back because, as I say, I just don't enjoy any of the things that's going on. On top of that, Caitlin, although it's definitely not as bad as our experiences in Secret of Evermore, I am increasingly starting to think that calibrating a stamina bar properly is really hard. I don't oppose all stamina bars all the time. Sometimes, like, there's stamina bars in Helldivers. Works fine there. There are stamina bars in Elden Ring and in the Soulsborne games. They generally work okay there. But the stamina bar in Eternal Strands doesn't feel good. And the stamina limitation makes the game feel sluggish. And so on top of the fact that the controls feel, you know, a little bit bad all the time, that just amplifies things. And so Eternal Strands for me is a somewhat ambitious miss on the part of a new studio and some people that there's a lot of talent behind. There's some vision here. This is the kind of thing that I could easily imagine being good in the sequel. I don't know if there's going to be enough interest. But, you know, a little bit more polish and there could have been something here. But all told, Eternal Strands, I think, is a disappointment and one that I am not going to be returning to. I'm very glad I was able to try it at Game Pass. We, of course, here and all my best friends are digital, though no necessary fans of Microsoft are big defenders of Game Pass. QV, my ability to be able to try Monster Hunter Rise on a whim and play Eternal Strands and walk away from it after a couple of hours and not feel like I've wasted any money and be able to play games like Hellblade 2. So that's Eternal Strands. I assume you haven't tried it yet.
I have not. So you said that the stamina bar feels kind of rough. Do you have to use that stamina bar when you're doing all this climbing around and, you know, kind of Breath of the Wild? Have you played Breath of the Wild? I don't know.
No, I have not breathed the wild.
Well, any climbing game style where you actually have stamina and it runs out while you're doing stuff.
Everything you do other than walking will consume stamina.
Really?
So clamber all over a big dude, stamina goes down. Use your sword, stamina goes down. Block an attack, stamina goes down. Now, I will say this. They didn't make hanging on to a big dude cost that much stamina.
Okay. Like
compared to running, for example, which drains your stamina faster, or attacking, which drains it much faster than that. But the fact that you have to, you know, you're doing the best thing in the game. You're doing the most fun thing in Eternal Strands. And you just constantly have to be looking over at that bar and jump off or fall. Just when things were getting good. Now, to be fair, this is kind of the paradigm. You know, it works roughly the same way in Shadows of the Colossus. It works roughly the same way in Dragon's Dogma, both of them. But nonetheless, it's just when you're not clambering all over a big thing, actually, I found the stamina bar works less well.
Oh.
It's actually kind of at its best when you're clambering all over a big thing. Just when you're trying to slash away at some wolves awkwardly, and your stamina bar is causing you problems. It's just it's not fun. It doesn't feel like it adds to tension or management or build considerations or balancing issues like they would in a Souls board game. It just feels like it's one more way in which Eternal Strands is being clunky and not letting me do fun things.
Did you learn while playing Eternal Strands whether or not your stamina can get upgraded over time?
So the only thing you can upgrade is your gear and your magical powers.
Okay.
There might be a blueprint of gear that increases your stamina or increases your stamina regeneration that I have not discovered. But as it is, there's no core default way. It's kind of baked in. It's kind of an action RPG, but it's less RPG-ish than even the Soulsborne games. You only have a very small number of stats, and there's not a whole lot of equipment tinkering. There's just a little bit of crafting that's layered on top of the action elements.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering, because in, I'm going to bring up Breath of the Wild again, even though you haven't played it. But in Breath of the Wild, like, you'll get multiple stamina bars. So even though climbing doesn't feel awesome at the beginning of the game, by the end, you can do a lot more. But it doesn't necessarily sound like this will be like that.
I think you'll find, actually, that gameplay innovation was pioneered in the seminal Little Kitty Big City.
Yes.
Which did the same thing, and thus, I will assume, inspired the game that came 4 years before it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually pretty sure that I've seen that mechanic in a lot of places. But but yeah.
Yeah, but we can agree it was invented somehow through time. Well, after all, look, we know that time paradoxes exist in Little Kitty Big City. The Tanuki tells us so.
Yes.
And so clearly it is responsible for all these redundant climbing bars. Anyway, Eternal Strands, do not recommend.
Okay. That's sad.
It is sad, and now I'm sad. So let us move on to gaming opinions on old school funware Goof. We're going to be talking about Chip 'n Dale Rescue Rangers. This is the second Capcom Disney licensed platformer they did. The first was in 1989 with DuckTales, which retro game nerds like me rave about constantly, despite the fact that I haven't played it. And in 1990 saw Chip 'n Dale Rescue Rangers. So this is one of your suggestions, Caitlin. Was this one a game that you played back in the day?
It was, which I'm now realizing I think we've done a lot of those the last few weeks.
That's fine.
Chip 'n Dale Rescue Rangers had a two-player mode, so I played this one a lot with my twin sister.
How did it hold up?
Okay, so I was pretty down on it early on because I was like, oh my god, this game is so hard. And okay, so I think that I feel like the platforming felt pretty good. Like, I really liked, I mean, I felt like I was able to do pretty good jumps. The character generally did things that I thought it was going to do.
Yep.
The main thing about Chip 'n Dale Rescue Rangers that bit me is I didn't feel like my character's hitbox made any sense. There were times when I was trying to like slowly creep towards something in order to jump over it, and I would get hit. And I wouldn't think that I was supposed to get hit there. But other than that, it wasn't too bad. I ended up beating the game today, which I've never done before. I did not beat it as a child. I did remember that save states existed. I would not have beaten it without save states, for the record.
Take that, 8-year-old Caitlin.
Yeah, they do some cute stuff with it. At first, when I started playing, I didn't read instruction manual or anything. So I just kind of figured out the controls as I went along. And at first I was like, okay, so you can pick up boxes and throw them. Okay, like, that's fine, I guess. It's a little boring. But then I realized you can actually hide inside the boxes. And for some reason, enemies die when they walk into you when you're in a box. I don't know why they can walk by boxes normally, but not when you're in one. But whatever.
Chip 'n Dale could teach Solid Snake a thing or two about the tactical use of boxes.
They certainly could, yes.
I agree with you about the hit detection. It did seem all over the place. This is compounded by the issue that enemies are very large, they move fast and erratically.
Yes.
It's the kind of game where you just always have to be wandering around with a box and just be ready to hit down whenever an enemy shows up.
Yes.
I guess that's not entirely unlike being a rodent when you're surrounded by mechanical dogs. I mean, just be prepared and get ready to hide at any... Apparently, mechanical dogs were a big thing in the show. I've never seen the show.
Okay.
I watched the intro segment, which seemed vaguely familiar. I think I saw trailers for it when I was watching other cartoons that abutted it. I think it might have run before or after DuckTales or Gargoyles or some of the other Disney stuff that I did watch at the time.
Probably.
And I don't think the music is represented in the NES game. That was one thing I was curious about, because that's one of the things you do in a licensed 8 or 16-bit game, or even any licensed game, you rip off the music.
Yeah.
They definitely did that in Aladdin. Huh. And I was somewhat curious to see if they did that in Chip and Dale, but I don't think they did.
That's a good question. I mean, the only thing I even remember from Chip and Dale at this point is the very beginning of the intro song where they're like, Chip and Dale. So that's all I can remember.
Well, that's not the very beginning. It opens with a gloomy bass-heavy bit that's kind of spooky and kind of at odds with a couple of chipmunks, one of whom wearing an aviator jacket, the other one wearing a Hawaiian shirt for some reason.
Yeah.
And then it goes into Chip and Dale.
Okay.
And then it gets a little bit more upbeat, but still relatively bass-heavy, which I approve of. Bass is great. But the overall structure of things, I mean, I was reminded, this is a very common thing of children's cartoons. You've got the sort of like rotund animal-looking things, but then they have to have the girl character. And the girl character is not shaped like everyone else. The no. girl character is usually taller and shaped like a human woman caricature.
Yeah.
Hourglass figure and the whole thing. And it's very unsettling. I get very unnerved. I'm not unnerved by animalistic characters. I'm unnerved by animalistic characters where the universe is inconsistent. Like, the classic one being Pluto and Goofy, mm-hmm. one of them being sapient and one of them not. One of them being bipedal, the other one being not. And I don't know, because the what's her name? Gizmo? I can't remember.
Gadget. I think.
Gadget.
Yeah.
So is she a chipmunk too?
I think she's a mouse, but I don't actually know.
Okay, some rodent. Some kind of rodent.
Yeah.
And she does not look... Anyway, it's visually discordant, and it unnerves me. I'm even going to set aside the insect that somehow, in the context of the game, murders everything.
Oh my god,
Invincibility in Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers is represented by some character who is this bug... And you open a box, the bug is in there, and not only are you invincible, but the bug systematically destroys every enemy you encounter.
Oh my god, yeah, he does.
It's kind of strange. I don't necessarily get it.
That's okay. I don't either. I don't remember that character existing, but it apparently did. I have to believe that in the cartoon he's probably not much of a mass murderer, but... the video game changes that. That we know of. Yes, you're right.
They often tend to be highly functioning members of society. I've watched Dexter. I know how this works. The other thing that Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers has in the vein of classic platforms of the era is deadly birds.
Oh my
god. Birds being vastly more deadly than anything else. Gotta love them deadly birds. Yep. Here, at least, they're huge. In Castlevania games, they're normally tiny, but here at least they're proportionally scaled.
Yes.
And the fact that rodents would be very, very vulnerable to birds, I can believe that.
Yeah. What were they? I think there was pelicans. The pelicans were my least favorite Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers bird. Because if you throw a crate at them, you can throw it. If you throw it at their upper half of their body, because they're like two boxes tall. If you throw it at the upper half, they will eat the box and spit it back out at you. Just very uncool.
Yeah, that's not great.
So you have to hit them in the feet. But the level where they are prominent is one where there's fans that are blowing you in one direction or the other. And you have to you have to manage to like jump, throw the box so that it hits the pelican in the feet in order to kill the pelican. Otherwise, you somehow need to jump on top of the fan and be on the one pixel of the fan before you touch the bird. Where you're not getting pushed to the left in order to, like, it's all a mess.
Well, I'm glad you came to terms with it. I, personally, given its pedigree, I was expecting a little bit more. I thought it was serviceable, but not particularly memorable or necessarily worth revisiting, personally.
Yeah, I was Googling after I finished the game because I was wondering, okay, does anyone else actually... Did anyone even play Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers? Was it just me? No. Okay. Apparently, a lot of people think it's quite good. I don't think it's bad, but it wouldn't be in my top 10.
Put it that way. Yeah. No, I don't think it was bad. It was just a little bit awkward in the way that a lot of NES games were, and a little bit unreasonable in its difficulty in the sense that you're expected to memorize enemy locations in the way a lot of those games were to kind of pad their length. And given mm-hmm. the comparison to other Capcom stuff of, especially like a few years later, like, you know, 92, 93, 94, when they were really hitting their stride. Not that the stuff before that was deficient. Like, they were still putting out Mega Mans at this time. But, you know, given the lineage, I was expecting a little bit more. Then again, I don't really have any associations with the franchise, so I wasn't disappointed on that score, at least.
Yeah, I found myself trying to remember if I ever played the, was it DuckTales game that you mentioned? Is that the one that came before this one?
DuckTales in 89, people love that game. And yeah, it was the first Capcom Disney co-design. And people play the crap out of the DuckTales games to this day. It involves a lot of Scrooge McDuck going up and down on a pogo cane. It's very strange.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure I ever played that one.
I've played it for a few minutes and it was just strange. I don't necessarily have strong feelings about DuckTales. Mm-hmm. I will say, though, that there was one episode where they did a whole bit about hyperinflation that worked real well. I remember that to this day. They basically go to this isolated island, and a character that was introduced later on in the series, who's basically the accountant, has to explain scarcity to these people. It's kind of racist in hindsight, but he explains scarcity and currency to these people that exist exclusively on a system of cooperation and interdependency. And he basically says, look, this bottle cap, he's drinking a soda. Here, have this bottle cap. This is the only bottle cap on the island. That makes it valuable. You have something that nobody else has. And he's like, oh, okay. And they come back later and they're like fighting over this bottle cap. And they're like, okay, fine. We'll deliver like a bunch of bottle caps, but they deliver too many, and that leads to hyperinflation, and suddenly people are paying 10,000 bottle caps for a loaf of bread.
Oh, good.
Anyway, it was great. All right, that's enough about Disney property. So that's Chippendale Rescue Rangers. But before we move on to our feature game, let us take a brief break to hear from our sponsors.
Spring is here, and so are the deals at Dee Dee's Discounts. From trendy outfits to home makeovers, Dee Dee's has all the deals you need. I'm talking everything from sandals and sundresses to spring throw pillows and scented candles. You love a good deal? Get in your bag and get to Dee Dee's Discounts.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And we're back. So, the increasingly inappropriately named Hellblade 2, Senua's Saga, given that there isn't a Hellblade in this game, indeed there's no hell at all, but whatever, I don't name video games, I just complain about them. This was released by Ninja Theory in 2024, the sequel to Hellblade : Senua's Sacrifice. Don't worry, she does tons of sacrificing in this game as well. Caitlin, what are your thoughts?
So, I think I'm roughly halfway through Hellblade 2, and it feels almost exactly like Hellblade 1 to me.
They are very similar, there's no denying that.
Yeah, I mean, the combat is extremely similar. There's some of the same puzzles, not all of the same puzzles, but some of the same puzzles. The ones where you have to find, like, letters, basically, in the environment, those have persisted. Although I found them a little bit easier so far this time around.
So to contextualize, just as a recap of our review of the first Hellblade, we basically, I think, characterized it as a walking sim with just enough. Like, the combat was just enough, the puzzle solving was just enough. It was efficient, it was sparse, it could have been developed more, but, you know, they did a good enough job to punctuate the scenes of walking around with, here's a combat encounter, here's a little puzzle to solve, to, you know, make you think you're actually playing a video game rather than just a straightforward walking simulator. No shade on walking simulators. And Hellblade 2 does the same thing. So we can talk about the combat, we can talk about the story, we can talk about the puzzles. The puzzles have one new kind of puzzle There's the, you can manipulate terrain so that pieces either appear or disappear or go to the ceiling or go to the ground. Anyway, it's not significantly more complicated than the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the first one, there were these pattern recognition puzzles where you'd have to find these runes replicated in nature. And I agree with you entirely. They really just dumbed them down in Hellblade 2. Like, the first time you do it, it was so stupid, I had to assume it was meant to be a tutorial. And fortunately, it was. You know, you're told to find the symbol in the world, and there's literally this bright red thing hanging in the air. And I'm like, okay, well, yeah, that's a gimme. But later ones, they introduce this kind of yellow moss that is only on certain aspects of the terrain, and that's what you have to line up. And it was sufficiently badly done that I didn't even see the pattern. I just knew that the game wanted to find me the pattern, because in zooming in, when you adopt Senua's perspective and you kind of zoom into the pattern, that's the only time when you actually see the pattern. You don't see it when you actually trigger the solution to the puzzle, but you just know it's there because it can't be anywhere else, and it's so blindingly obvious.
Yep.
I'm not a huge puzzle fan, but I kind of liked the spot, the pattern things. Like, it used to be like, the timbers of a house are arranged in a particular way, and that's the sigil that you're looking for. And I sometimes had to go look around and explore the place and spend some time thinking about it. And now it's just, oh, here's the yellow moss. Bam.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the very first one that I did. I mean, it's like we're in this burned out village. There's just blood and everything everywhere. But then there's some, like, I guess, pieces of house, like large, you know, pieces of wood. And the top half is all red. And I'm like, I wonder if I can line that up to be a rune. Oh, look, I can. It was very obvious.
I almost felt insulted. It's kind of like the strategically placed, sometimes ice, sometimes I have to think guano, that is arranged in the terrain to indicate where you can climb.
Mm-hmm.
It's, a lot of games do this. Still Wakes the Deep did this. There was yellow where you could climb. It's very frequently yellow paint. There's a joke from, I think the Uncharted games use yellow paint as well. But here it was white. There was one scene that was particularly absurd, where even in a cutscene, Senua was climbing up a cliff, you're not even controlling her, and she's grabbing all these handholds, all of which are covered in ice. She's specifically grabbing the ice to climb up because that's how the game... Anyway, what I'm saying is they could have spent half a second thinking about how to render the game world better in this sense, in terms of gamifying it. And then there's the combat. How did you think... The combat's been changed slightly. Overall, you're right, it's very similar, but insofar as there are changes, do you have an opinion on what they did vis-a-vis the changes?
So, I don't know exactly what they did. What I have noticed is that... So, didn't you used to be able to kick things?
Yes. Like,
kick them away? And you can't do that anymore that I've been able to tell.
No.
Okay. So, I don't love that. I feel like anytime I need to dodge an enemy, it feels pretty clumsy. And I don't feel like Senua is a seasoned warrior. I feel like she is a, you know, just a scared woman trying not to get cut in half by a giant axe, which is fine.
¿Por qué no los dos?
The combat is less fun to me this time around. I used to be able, like, in the first Hellblade, I felt like I could parry pretty consistently. I think they had, like, a tell when you could parry or something. I can't remember. And that might even still be there. I'm not sure. But anyway, it felt a lot easier to parry before. Now, every now and then, I'm trying to parry, and somebody just punches me in the face instead. I'm like, oh, fine.
The combat used to be a borderline simplistic brawler-type setup. And now, I can't help but feel it's more like a series of QuickTime events, or like something out of those old Laserdisc games from the arcades, like Dragon's Lair. Because... In the first Hellblade, you might have two or three enemies of different types in some sort of rough circular arena. And you had to worry about where you were standing. You had to make sure you weren't being flanked. It wasn't the most complicated or thought-provoking thing in the world.
Yeah.
But it was nonetheless a thing to take into consideration. In Hellblade 2, you're only ever fighting one person at a time. And like clockwork, they do this so often, it's absurd. Again, almost insulting. You finish off the enemy, and then another enemy jumps on your back. Happens so often
mm-hmm.
that it became legit tedious, borderline comical.
Yeah. Like, Senua, stop turning your back toward the things that want to bite you in the neck. Just don't do it. Maybe make sure you can see both of them. I'd completely forgotten about that, but that's true, because the very first fight that I had, I was like, oh, wait, where's the other guy? I can't see the other guy anymore. And then realize, oh, he doesn't matter, unlike in the first game where you actually had to care about whether there were other enemies coming up behind you. So that's a good point.
I dodged. I would sidestep, I would sway away, but I never had to move, because there's no point. The enemy will come to you and get within sword range soon enough, and you don't have to worry about being flanked, because you're always going to get flanked, because the game has scheduled in the cutscene for you to be flanked with the same animation pattern 6 times in the same encounter.
Yeah, I don't know how Senua still has a neck anymore at this point, but...
Many a thing has nibbled on it. It's absolutely true. So in terms of the actual gameplay, I think that the sequel has taken a step back. Mm-hmm. I sincerely think that it was noticeably worse, but to be fair, I didn't appreciate the first Hellblade on the strength of its gameplay anyway.
Yeah.
So it was mostly something I was rolling my eyes at.
I can agree with that.
So let's talk about the story. It's... Oh my goodness. I have many feelings. What are your thoughts on the story of Hellblade 2?
So I guess before we get into it, what's our stance on Hellblade 1 spoilers?
I don't think we have to spoil it, because Hellblade doesn't know what happened in Hellblade 1. Am I wrong? Is this an unfair characterization? Taken as a collective, this is my perspective. Taken as a collective, Hellblade, as a series, has no idea what it has ever said about anything. And any possible interpretation of any given event has been asserted in the universe of Hellblade to have happened.
Yeah.
I sincerely believe that to be true.
Yeah, I can see that.
There are various things that happen in the first Hellblade.
Yes.
Because this is a story about a woman with mental illness. She has psychosis, she has neuroses, she hears voices that are called the Furies, and... The first game played with that a lot. The second game does as well, but at this point it's already been established, and Senua has, to a certain extent, come to terms with the Furies.
Yes.
Not entirely, but to a certain extent. And there are various things in the first Hellblade that were presented, various scenes, as presented as being metaphorical.
Yes.
As being representative of Senua's internal struggles with a variety of things, more on that later.
Mm-hmm.
And then... with respect to some of those things that were presented as metaphorical, Senua in the second one just shows up and says, yeah, those happened, I did those things, to like other people. And we're expected to believe that that's true. So
yeah.
Like Senua in Senua 1 acknowledges that this was just part of a representation of her inner struggle, but then in Senua 2 she's like, yeah, those things happened. Those were facts that occurred in the material world.
Okay.
I'm like, what?
Yeah, so you have addressed the exact thing that I wanted to talk about, except you were vague about the exact happenings, which is good. Yeah, I thought that was weird, and that made me not know what to think going through Hellblade 2. Not knowing, okay, well, is this literally happening then? Since apparently some of that other stuff literally happened, even though it didn't, as far as I could tell at the end of Hellblade 1.
And did you find that ambiguity interesting, or frustrating, or just confusing?
Kind or something of else? Frustrating?
I was there with you, yes.
Yeah, because, I mean, it made me unsure how to interpret things that were actively happening in Hellblade 2. In Hellblade 1, I took everything as face value, like, this is actually happening to Senua, she went to Helheim, blah, 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 blah. And then when the ending kind of made some of that a little bit more ambiguous, or was just like, yeah, this was less of a actual thing that happened and more of a metaphorical thing that happened... Now it's just in my head, like, is this real or is this metaphorical? And will the game ever tell me?
So here in Hellblade 2, the cast has expanded considerably.
Yes.
In the first game, there was basically one character, Senua. There were some voices in her head, and then there were some recollections she had of stories that she had heard from someone she knew growing up. And then there's voices of her father and her mother. But anyway, there's just one character going through hell.
Mm-hmm.
And there were just monsters in her way and recollections. Now, we are told, or at least is presented, that there is a cast of characters that is with her at various events.
Yes.
And so superficially, we're left with the position that either these people don't exist, and we're further down the rabbit hole of Senua just manifesting things, but they don't really represent aspects of her psyche, so that's not particularly plausible or satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
So then we're left with the more natural interpretation, which is that they're actually there. And so when they say, "Hey, Senua, that supernatural thing just happened," we as a user are left with a very strong impression that those things actually happened.
Yes.
It's infuriating. And the ending is in many ways worse than the ending of the first one in terms of, oh, you thought you knew what was happening? No, you don't. Because now it's like when it's just an unreliable narrator, you get to play with that stuff. And it to a certain extent, that's acceptable. But when it's when events are being validated by two other people, sometimes three, and then we're told, no, 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 those things didn't happen. Something else was happening. I'm like, but that, okay. I have no idea what happened. I played all of Hellblade 2. I can tell you beats that occurred during the game, but I can't tell you what any of them were. I'm thoroughly baffled.
Huh. Okay.
So part of this is exacerbated. I was so frustrated by this that I actually wrote a list.
Oh.
The story of Hellblade, the first one, I think consists primarily, though not exclusively, of the following three themes. Caitlin, tell me if I'm off base here.
Mm-hmm.
In no particular order. The power of love.
Mm-hmm.
Overcoming trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Many different kinds of trauma. The trauma of loss. The trauma of past abuse. The overarching metaphor of darkness representing that trauma. And then finally, seeing the truth through illusion or delusion, again, through the lens of mental illness. And those were some of the thematic elements running through the first game. The big themes that it dwells on.
Mm-hmm.
Have I left anything out, or have I introduced anything that isn't in the first game?
No, I don't know. I think you got it. Like, the thing that I was thinking of could probably fit into your second bullet point there. So, yeah, I think...
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, just, like, learning how to come to terms with loss.
Yeah. Loss is absolutely the huge, like, the biggest sort of overarching thing that drives the events of the game, certainly, because Hellblade is about Senua trying to get her lover back. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Hellblade 2 has all of those three themes as well. And additionally, it has the following themes too. The burden of leadership. Destiny versus free will. Hurt people hurt people. The tension between security and liberty. The redemptive power of forgiveness. The nature of promises. And also an additional level of overcoming trauma. And that is moving past trauma so as to be able to trust others. This is too much in a six-hour game.
Yeah, sure.
To be fair, and Caitlin, if you think I'm being unfair, please tell me, these are not things that I am just saying, like, oh, well, you're gesturing towards this idea that you could have chosen to tease out. No. These are legit themes that the game touches on through the explicit events and dialogue of the scenes and of the action.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, it doesn't develop any of them satisfactorily because it's juggling all these different ideas. Any one of these could ground an entire game.
Yeah.
They pulled off three-ish in Hellblade 1, roughly to my satisfaction. I came away from Hellblade 1 pretty satisfied with the story.
Yeah.
Even though I was a little confused by some of the things that it was playing with. But Hellblade 2 is just biting off way more than it can chew. And consequently, it just has this confused jumble of things going on, personally, in terms of the story developments.
Yeah, I remember thinking that... So again, I believe I'm roughly halfway through Hellblade 2. And I remember thinking when we meet one of those first side characters and, you know, Senua sees, like, oh, he has the same darkness in him that I used to have. I was like, okay, this is probably going to be, like, the main thing. But then... they don't touch on it very much in the next few hours, like a little bit here and there. But yeah, so I even though I haven't finished it, I can absolutely see where you're coming from.
Yeah, it's and that is another example also of how they don't really want to come to terms with the ambiguity that they were walking in the first game. Like, for example, the second character that Senua meets, she makes some comment that she thinks he can hear the Furies, which means... either he's telepathic, which they don't really seem to imply, or the Furies aren't just manifestations of Senua's psychosis, but are actually something supernatural, or any combination of those. Does the game elaborate on this? No. Does the game elaborate on whether the darkness that Senua sees in the other character is metaphorical or literal? Well, she sees something on his arm that looks like the physical manifestation of darkness from the first game.
Yeah.
But we were led to believe that that was metaphorical. Or is it? Yeah. Who knows? There's ambiguity and then there's confusion. Mm-hmm. And I sincerely believe that the writing staff, if they weren't confused, they at least couldn't clarify their intent clearly enough to leave the viewer with anything to latch onto. Part of it, again, is just the volume of stuff they were throwing at the wall. And it's not that the game is frenetically paced or that there's too much going on. They just don't develop any of these ideas. I like a lot of these ideas. These are interesting ideas.
I played through the whole arc with the first kind of antagonist that is brought up, the supernatural antagonist. And if this had been in Hellblade 1, I would have very much thought that this character was not real.
Yeah.
But given that there's tons of people, including your two main companions at the time, who all acknowledge, like, yes, this is a real thing. I mean, what? Like, oh, okay, this is real now?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I really like those gameplay sequences. I'm going to call them boss fights, so as not to spoil anything. The sort of boss fights that exist that don't actually use the combat engine, but instead have these big set pieces.
Yeah.
I think are great.
Yeah.
I found them gripping, compelling, super interesting, super visually well done. And I agree with you that to them have them capped off, and I assure you, Caitlin, it gets worse as the game goes on. To have them capped off with some sort of sense of what exactly just happened is not satisfying. And it kind of cheapens the overall experience. So one might be led to question, Mark, given all these complaints, why did you finish the darn thing? Well, two reasons. Number one, it was only 6 hours long. And number two, I thought about this. I spent some time thinking about this. I think Hellblade 2 Senua's Saga is the greatest looking video game I've ever played, bar none. It is sumptuously gorgeous in everything that it does. Mm-hmm. I talked before in the context of Dragon's Dogma and Eternal Strands about how it can be difficult to just render landscapes in a compelling way. But Hellblade 2 has the most stunning, blasted landscapes. The way they just do rocks is amazing. It's so gorgeous. The facial motion capture. I didn't have hardly any Uncanny Valley experiences at all.
Yeah.
The photorealism on display is breathtakingly gorgeous. It's amazing.
Yeah, completely agreed. I guess Hellblade 1 had like those actual video sequences every now and then.
Yeah.
And this one just, I believe, shows everything in engine and it looks really, really good.
So Hellblade 1 used Unreal 4. And it was super resource intensive. And quite frankly, I didn't see where those resources were going. I thought it looked fine. And indeed, the motion capture of Senua's face was super impressive. But I didn't quite understand why it was such a beast to run. So this runs on Unreal 5. My PC tower was squealing like a banshee because the fan had to go into overdrive all the time. And every time the fan kicked in so loud that I could hear it over everything was going on, I was like, yeah, keep up the good work. And I just turned up the volume on my speakers. Because I could see, there's no difficulty seeing why it's so difficult. They're not only do they up their game on Senua's facial motion capture, but there's an entire cast of people and they all look seamless.
Mm-hmm.
It is amazing. It is somehow simultaneously like photorealistic, but also video game stylized. Like you get the best of both worlds all at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's a technical triumph. I was willing to forgive so much just because I was so slack-jawed in appreciation of the visuals. And I'm normally not like that.
Yeah.
With video games.
No, it was absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I appreciated that there was a photo mode in it because I could just... Yeah, it was beautiful.
Well, every game's got a photo mode now. And... They used the graphics to good effect.
They did.
The camera work is great, the pseudo camera work. The performances are marvelous. The entire cast is just supremely well done, and they render the faces so beautifully. And they, again, all the technical tricks that they pulled off in Hellblade 1 are here again. They're a little less effective because you're used to them now, you know, the Furies coming at you from different directions, mm-hmm. causing you to doubt your own actions, telling you you're going the wrong way. It's like, hey, yeah, I've been here, but it's still kind of effective.
Yeah.
And I will give an actual content warning to people. I normally don't do this. If you suffer from claustrophobia, do not play Hellblade 2.
Yeah, that's fair.
There are a number of scenes that I'm not particularly claustrophobic, but there were a couple of sequences where I was like, ugh.
Oh, yeah. Deeply uncomfortable. I mean, even times when Senua is just squeezing through, you know, a couple rocks, they really make you feel like she's doing that. A lot of other games are like, oh, we're just going to do a little shuffle and it's fine. But no, she's like exerting herself trying to squeeze through this really small area and got me a little freaked out a couple times.
Yeah, the non-loading screens.
Yeah.
Where they were hiding the loading. Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any more thoughts about Hellblade 2, Caitlin?
I don't think so. I'm hoping to beat it sometime this week, so we'll see.
You're taking your sweet time. Jeez. Yeah, okay, you're about halfway done.
Okay.
I guess you're just better at finding the side stuff.
I thought I was doing a good job, and then all of a sudden I find the next, like, rune marker, and it's like, oh, you missed three of them, sucker. I'm like, what are you talking about? Actually, that's a big pet peeve of mine with both Senua Saga games. Focus, and you activate one of these letters, and they start telling you a story, and you can't walk away and listen to it. You have to stand there, not doing anything.
It is annoying. That was one of the things that Veilguard did exceptionally well, actually. Like, your companions might be talking to each other or initiating a dialogue event. If they're interrupted by combat or if they're interrupted by any plot-relevant things,
yeah.
After it's over, one of them will say, as I was saying, yes. And then just leap right back into it so you know you're not missing anything. I quite appreciated that.
Me too.
And given that Senua is basically either remembering things or getting things fed into her head, it would have been nice for her to be able to wander away from the tree or rock that is nominally speaking to her.
Yeah.
To sum up, I have a lot of frustrations with the second Hellblade. I think it is considerably less accomplished and compelling than the first one. I don't regret having finished it, though, because I still find Senua to be a compelling character, and the performances were great, and it was technically beautiful. I just really think they need to have a little bit more focus, which, quite frankly, this is a classic problem with sequels as it is. Sometimes you have feature bloat. Here we didn't have feature bloat. It was just thematic bloat. They decided to swing for the fences a little bit, and they couldn't quite tell a coherent story as a consequence, I think. But I would play a third.
Yeah.
So there's that. So that does it for Hellblade 2, Senua's Saga. We now move on to shameless hyping of upcoming titles, what we call Shout. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out?
So today, I'm going to be predictable and just shout out Monster Hunter Wilds again. It's been a little while since the first time I did, but this time I've played the beta in the last few days, and I am pumped. I am really excited for when Monster Hunter Wilds comes out for realsies. How about you, Mark?
Well, I'm going to be true to form as well, and I'm going to shout out an upcoming roguelite game. Specifically Sworn. This is by Windwalk Games. It is currently in early access, so it is not a real game for me yet, but they have promised a, quote, swift and exciting, end quote, early access period, and they expect to be out of early access by 2025 May, which means that it might be in early access for the next 25 years. So, this is a sort of Arthurian Legends dark retelling kind of thing. There's going to be co-op, there's going to be roguelite progression. It is a whole deal. I haven't played it yet, but based on gameplay videos, it's very much aping Hades in terms of pacing of the combat, which was one of my chief complaints about Raven's Watch. It felt a little bit sluggish to me, whereas Sworn looks a little bit more dynamic, a little bit faster paced. And so I am looking forward to it coming out of early access.
Sweet. It looks pretty neat. I hadn't heard of it, so I would definitely play this.
That is Sworn by Windwalk Games. And that's going to do it for this episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. Thank you so much for joining us. If you're all inclined to support free and independent media, you can find us on patreon.com/amfad. But we appreciate your having spent your most valuable resource, your time, with us this week. And we hope to see you again soon. Please do take care, everyone. Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store by April 2nd to save.
$20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.